This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to episode number 7. In this episode, we continue our conversation with the prolific Android developer, Jake Wharton. We continue to talk about Android, open source, RxJava, and RxAndroid, and much, much more. Let's get back to the show.
So another big topic that I'd love to talk about is testing in general. And I know you are a big proponent of like good testing, and like most of the projects you've worked on have excellent tests, both in terms of coverage and the kinds of tests. One question I've always wanted to ask you is, if you started a greenfield project, like you start from scratch, a brand new project, what would your approach to testing be? What are the frameworks you would use specifically for Android? How would you go about testing? Are there things that you're okay just like letting it slip without having to actually test it? What would your approach be?
Yeah, so this is definitely a hot issue, and I think it's one that there isn't a great answer to in general. Mm-hmm. So we just have to kind of try and do the best we can. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think my approach if I was starting a brand new project is actually very similar to what I would just do right now, because the app we work on is a little under-tested, and one of the things we're focusing on in the future is going to be just adding a lot more test infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there's three kind of main things that I would go after. The first would just be unit testing. Unit testing is kind of just classically been a very challenging problem on Android. We've had so-called unit testing that runs on the devices. But when I talk about unit testing, I'm specifically talking about like on JVM, like during development, mm-hmm. unit testing. So we've obviously seen great advances come from the tools team in this area extremely recently to actually bring unit testing on JVM unit testing to Android. And I think a lot of people don't realize that this is actually the first time that this has ever been a first party solution for unit testing. So you could unit test back when you were doing, the Ant-based build system, or if you were using Maven, but it was never something that was offered by Google as like a first party solution. You were always kind of just doing it yourself and working around problems. So I think that's really big, especially since hopefully we'll see a lot more things come out of this to make it easier to do unit testing in the future. Mm. Anyway, trying to get more concrete here, but, obviously, unit testing, I think, historically has been done the wrong way. And I think we've seen this directly as a result of RoboElectric. So it's right. It's both a blessing and a curse. But for whatever reason, people are just fascinated by the idea of like running their whole activity and services and, doing fragment transitions inside of unit tests. And that is the wrong place to be doing those. And I think there's two real reasons for that. One is that it devalues the actual content of the test by cluttering it with lifecycle and a bunch of ceremony to get those things to happen. So you devalue the actual test case that you're trying to test. And I think the other problem is that you end up testing the wrong thing. Yes, you're going to, hit your code. You're going to run your on resume method and test some behavior, but your test is also testing the RoboElectric implementation of these life cycles and these mechanisms.
If the shadows exist.
All right. So if that changes or, the behavior goes from synchronous to asynchronous or, there's so many unknowns there. And the fact that you're relying on those behaviors in your test is going to make them extremely brittle. And again, it's going to devalue the actual test itself.
Right. I mean, anytime the framework interferes with your unit tests, you're probably doing something wrong there.
Yeah. So I think a great example of the right things to unit test You know, everyone says, oh, unit test your business logic, but I think that's lost on a lot of people. They don't really understand what that means and how to do that. So a good example I like to give, and one of the unit tests that we actually have is, and it also illustrates kind of an interesting problem with the tool support for unit testing, is testing our handler for incoming intents. So a lot of apps will handle external intents, such as web URLs. You know, if you visit, twitter.com/whatever, some URL, the Twitter app, if installed, is going to handle that and has to navigate to that person's profile. And so our app has this functionality as well. And what we've done is pull that into a class. And this class is responsible for taking an intent and returning a destination. You know, where should the app go given this intent? And the entirety of that class is business logic. It is pulling data out of the intent, parsing it, and then turning it into a representation of where the app should navigate to.
Yep.
And this is the perfect thing to unit test, because we just create an intent in our test, you know, http://twitter.com/jakewharton. We call the single method of this class, which is, you know, handle intent. And then we get back an object, and then we assert things about that object. Oh, did it tell me to go to the profile view? And if it did, you know, the test passes. And if it didn't, we know we broke our business logic for handling intents. And that's like, I find that as like a great example, because those are the kind of things that you should be testing. Mm-hmm. I don't think, and what people otherwise would do with like a RoboElectric solution, is they would fire that intent in the test, and then they would assert that the right activity was started and that the activity was started and is displaying my profile. That is not a unit test. And that is not the right thing to be doing in a unit test. You know, that belongs on a device actually running the app. And that's probably more of a functional or integration test.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, so the other thing I really like about this example is that it brings up an interesting problem with how unit testing works, which is the mockable jar, the mockable Android jar, which is what it's called, which is basically replacing all of the Android classes, all the Android APIs with empty implementations that don't do anything. And this is problematic because intent is basically just a wrapper around a map. It has keys and it has values, right? That's all an intent is. You put stuff in and you pull stuff out. But the behavior of the unit test version is nothing. So, you know, you call put string and there's nowhere for it to store that data because it just does nothing. So a lot of people would turn to like mocking. Well, I'll just mock the intent. Well, now you're running into the same problem again, where you're going to devalue your test, because now your test has to understand how intent works and you have to mock the behavior of intent. Mm-hmm. And ironically, this is where RoboElectric is great, because the intent class in RoboElectric is the real intent class. And the, you know, intent has a bundle, which is where it's which is the map where it stores its data. And bundle is the real bundle, and map is obviously the real map. So you get the real behavior that you would get on Android. So it kind of highlights the problems that we see with unit testing right now, which is there's not a great way to do it because of this problem. RoboElectric, gives you intent and bundle, but it also gives you control over activity life cycles, which is the wrong thing to do. And mocking is the wrong approach, because you're going to end up mocking Android behavior. But the tools team can't, they're also going to have a problem where they say, oh, well, we'll provide like intent. We'll make intent a real class, but everything else will be stubs. But that's not going to work either, because where does that stop?
Exactly.
You know, yeah. What if I want bundle? Well, what if I want parcelable or parcel? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people don't know that parcel is native code.
Yes.
So now you're talking about, well, do we mock the native part of parcel, or do we try and compile the native code to run on your JVM. So, you know, and that's how RoboElectric started, is they want, oh, I just want intent, you know, I just want bundle, and it spirals out of control. So, anyway, what I'm saying is basically it's really hard to know what to do and what the right approach is. So concretely, we use RoboElectric, but we strictly kind of constrain ourselves to only use it for the simple things that we know are real. So whether it's URL or URI rather, or intent or bundle, and we stay far, far away from, you know, the service activity fragment, all of that support, which is designed to put functional and instrumentation like testing on the JVM. But yeah, so that's unit testing. You guys talked a lot about UI testing. You know, Espresso is obviously the canonical implementation of what you should be using. I think an important thing to note about using Espresso that a lot of people don't do is that it's probably not a wise idea to put actual like on view, perform click, all that stuff. It's probably not wise to actually have that inside every single test case, because it basically is the same problem again, where you're going to be devaluing your test by putting implementation details of the UI in every single test. So a really easy pattern is basically just pulling those out into like screen specific helpers. So if you have a test that's for your, you know, sign in screen, which has an email, a password, and a button, maybe pull those out into just a simple static method, which is sign in with email and password.
Interesting.
Because then, you know, when inevitably you change that screen, be it from your own requirements or design or whatever, whenever you change that screen, you only have to change the test in one place, which is that static method. And then every test, which is calling into that static method, gets the new behavior. And then the test itself becomes more readable, because you don't have all the nonsense of dealing with Espresso in the test. All you have is sign in with email and password, foo@example.com, and password. And that very declaratively tells you the action, the intent of the test, and not the implementation of how that actually gets executed.
Oh, fantastic. It's almost like you're building like an internal sort of DSL for your tests, right? So you can sort of like point to these actions.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly it.
And what about like the UI sort of Espresso, sort of like the gray box side? Do you guys do a lot of actual UI tests, like using UI Automator or something along those lines? For example, one problem with Espresso is like if you're trying to test sort of things where you like, I don't know, like if your app, for example, has to connect to Facebook or like some other sort of third-party service, which requires you to sort of move away from your application, UI Automator right now seems to be like the only choice. Do you sort of use it, or do you try to avoid actually testing those kind of things, or like what's your approach been there?
Yeah, that's a good example. Actually, we do have instances like that where we call out to your email client. Mm-hmm. Or your SMS client. And the way we actually do that is, so we don't use UI Automator. And this is simply, well, there's probably a few reasons, but the most concrete one is that we just don't have the time to maintain all these things. The team I work on is extremely small, and we have to pick and choose our battles, and supporting all those different types of testing is just not something we can do. So in order to work around that, we do something which I think is actually extremely clever, which is basically replacing that intent with one that, instead of calling out to, say, email as an example, what we do is we have a activity in our debug builds, which all it does is print out, it accepts an intent, and it just prints out data that's inside the intent, just, you know, in text views. And that's it. Obviously we're using Dagger and injections. So we basically inject this intent starter. I forget what it's called, but rather than calling, you know, activity start, start activity or whatever, we call intent, whatever, start intent. And in the debug case, in our debug builds, instead of firing the real intent, it wraps that intent in one that just opens this debug activity and displays the data. And then this allows you to stay inside your process, inside your app, in your instrumentation tests, but still verify, you can still see the data that would otherwise have been launched and potentially write, tests against that data. And it's actually, so it's useful for tests. It's also useful for just manual debugging, manual testing of the app. Like, I don't want to be launching the email app every time I'm just manually, messing around with our app. So we actually, this is turned on by default for just normal usage of the app. And this debug activity, this intent activity, it has a button that lets you launch the real intent. So if you're just messing around as a human, you can still launch the real intent if you want to.
Ah, interesting. So it's almost like using Dagger, you would have something like this intent that you're talking about is maybe like an SMS handler or something of that sort. And then like in the debug build, you'll just swap out the SMS handler for this activity that you've sort of created to sort of mimic the functionality.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually an example of this in the U2020 app. It was recently updated by a coworker and myself over the last month or so, mostly him, because he gave a talk at DroidCon Montreal about how we do development builds, like what we add to our development builds in order to speed up development. And this was one of the things that he touched on. And so U2020 fires an intent to open a browser. And so we have this mechanism in place in U2020 where you can, instead of opening the browser, it opens this separate activity and shows you the data that was inside the intent. So if people want to check that out, that's a very concrete example of that pattern.
Fantastic. We'll add a link to that. All right. So the last point I want to quickly touch on before we move on to the next topic is, like, do you have a quick opinion on like running fast tests? Like, this is like something I've seen in other sort of platforms, like especially in web development and stuff. Like, fast tests is sort of very important in terms of doing stuff like TDD. Do you have like a quick opinion on that?
I mean, we don't have anything like that. I mean, I think unit tests are an example of those.
Right.
But obviously you can't cover everything with unit tests. The Android framework for running instrumentation tests has the ability to annotate like small test and large test.
Right.
And you can run only the small tests or whatever. So people actually, I don't think they realize how fast those tests can actually be. The hard part about those tests is just having the device or having the emulator and getting it started and deploying the APKs, which is especially slow nowadays, even with ART, because it has to go through that compilation step on the device. But once the APKs are actually there, the running of the tests is blazingly fast, especially if you're using, Genymotion or the x86 emulator. It's actually going to be faster than a real device. Mm-hmm. So if you're writing tests that interact with not so much pieces of your UI, but more of the Android framework, the things that you wouldn't necessarily unit test, but maybe you don't want to write, full on integration functional style tests for. Those are actually a really good way to, assuming you have an emulator or device always plugged in or running, it's a really good way to like get a feel for ensuring that you're not breaking anything in, your big refactors or your new feature or whatever.
Right.
It's not something that we actually do right now, but I can aspire to it, I guess.
Okay. A last question I had is, what does Square basically do for the server side stuff? Some time back, you touched upon saying that Java is basically sort of like the language that you've come to sort of like and develop on. Do you use that also for your like backend server side stuff? Do you use like a different language, or what are your thoughts on that? If you had to like sort of recommend a, server-side framework in Java that you sort of like to use? Or
yeah, so we do use Java for most of our backend infrastructure at Square. We have a mix of, so it's mostly Java, especially around the actual core of our infrastructure, which is like moving money and the very serious things.
The enterprise stuff. Yeah.
Although we're not using like a Java EE or Spring or anything like that. We do lean on libraries like, you know, Jersey and JaxRS, but we have our own like container that wraps it all and manages services and stuff. But then we also have a mix of Go for some things, which is a relative newcomer. And then we have a lot of Ruby as well. And the Ruby serves for internal tooling and public facing websites. But Java, I think a point that a lot of people miss in our open source libraries is that the majority of them actually are not Android specific. So your OKIOs, your OKHDPs, your Retrofit, you talked about Moshi, all of these things we actually use on the server side as well because they're just plain Java libraries.
Yeah, makes sense. Speaking about languages, you sort of released this sort of document where you did a in-depth study about Kotlin. So that was amazing, by the way. I was always on the fence about Kotlin and not necessarily sort of like delving too much into it. But what are your thoughts on those kind of languages? Like, so do you actually use Kotlin in any sort of, I don't know, maybe production app isn't what I'm looking at, but do you, have you used Kotlin in like an actual app that you sort of personally use? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
So if we don't use it in any Square apps currently. We are using it for tests in one of our apps. They're basically using the kind of DSL nature that you can write and using it to write their tests, right? Basically to eliminate a lot of the redundancies that Espresso brings. And kind of going back to what I said about refactoring, refactoring like these higher level methods, instead of using like whatever static methods and passing contexts around, they're using Kotlin for that and Kotlin's DSL. I think so. I've written like toys with it, little toy apps,
right?
But yeah, we're very excited to start using it, but I think we are extremely limited by the fact that all of our apps rely on annotation processors. And so that's a big caveat right now is that the Kotlin compiler does not run annotation processors. And this you know, makes sense because Kotlin is a completely different language. It has a completely different way that it models the language in the compiler. And annotation processors rely on the way that Java models itself in the compiler. So currently a limitation, they've talked about supporting it and hopefully eventually we'll figure out a way to adapt the models so that annotation processors can just run out of the box. We actually see this just this week with Groovy. The new version of Gradle actually will create Java stubs. So you'll take your Groovy classes and create stubs which represent the public API of those classes as Java code and then give that to annotation processors. So you can run a annotation processor without any modification on Groovy code. So it's a very interesting approach. I don't know if the Kotlin team will take that similar approach or they'll try and either come up with their own version of annotation processing. Basically, that's our big limiting factor just because it's so prevalent in basically every facet of our apps, the use of these annotation processors, that it's really hard to switch anything to Kotlin. And of course, there are ways of working around it with, you know, having split some stuff in Java and other things in Kotlin, and then pulling the parts in Java which use the annotation processor, pulling those just into your Kotlin classes, but until I think that gets resolved, you won't see it gain any widespread adoption for us. But in general, I mean, I really love the language. I think it gets a lot of things right. And I think they focus on a lot of the right things. Mm-hmm. So I'm extremely hopeful in the future to be able to use it. And I think they're very aware of these things. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of embracing the appeal to Android developers now a lot more.
Right.
So hopefully we'll see in the future better support for this use case.
Makes sense. I'll add a link to Anko as well, which is another sort of variant they've added for Kotlin, specifically for Android.
Yeah, they have that, and they have the Android extensions, which is what I think it's called, the view binding.
Yeah,
I don't know how I feel about those. I would rather see them focus on really nailing the language first. Yeah. And then kind of come back to those things. I don't find either of those libraries appealing right now. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how they play out over, the next year or so as the language evolves.
Right. My thoughts exactly. I mean, if you can like sort of pin down this approach where we can move away from Java 6 or at least like the sort of shackles that we have with the JDK 6 and like focus on getting a good language out there that we can start using, then that in itself is like a sort of sigh of relief for most Android developers. Like we're good right now with the whole view binding thing. Butterknife helps us there. So like we're sort of good there. So if they can figure out that other piece, that would be pretty cool.
So you had spoke a little bit about Kotlin now and so forth. Now I think Kaushik and I had discussed in a previous episode that some people use the JDK 6, some are 7 or 8. Which one are you running on, Jake? Is it 7, 8, or 6, or what?
Yeah, I have the latest JDK 8. Mm-hmm. I'm always kind of trying to keep up with the bleeding edge of Java. Just because, again, this goes back to the importance of diversifying, the things that you're being exposed to. So I was on the beta releases of JDK 8, for 8 months before it was actually released. I've actually compiled and installed both JDK 9 and JDK 10 to toy around with because, you can clone them and they're very easy to compile and, they basically just work. I've accidentally made open source releases with JDK 9 once.
Wow, nice.
But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to be learned from just keeping pace with, what's happening in Java, even if we can't yet use that on Android. Mm-hmm. And especially with the stuff that's coming down for Java 10, mm-hmm. just being aware of the development on that is, I think, very important because it actually has huge ramifications for Android potentially because it could eliminate a lot of the GC pressure of short-lived objects. I don't want to kind of get too into it. I actually one of my links for your awesome picks is going to be related to Java 10. So
cool.
I'll let people follow up on it by themselves.
So for Android though, are you compiling with the JDK 8? Is that what you're using?
Yeah, JDK 8's my default.
Have you run into any issues with that at all?
No, I mean the Java compilers have always cross-compiled to previous versions of the language. So there's obviously solutions like Retro Lambda that allow you to actually use the Java 8 language features.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm using JDK 8 as my compiler, but I'm only using the Java 6. Java 7 language features that the default tools allow.
Gotcha.
A big thing there is Java 8 eliminated the permanent generation. If you're familiar with how like garbage collection and how the heap works,
mm-hmm.
Java 8 eliminated the perm gen, which was actually a cause of a lot of crashes for compilation. So if like a Gradle plugin or something spun out of control, you'd often get like a perm gen crash.
Yep.
And while it doesn't fix the underlying problem, if you just switch to JDK 8, there is no perm gen anymore, so it can't run out. and while it may like churn through, you know, your heap and kind of blow up your RAM, eventually it will finish and all that stuff will be restored. So it kind of, you know, saves you a bit there.
Cool. So do you have a ton of libraries that you've released personally and that have been released with your teammates at Square? Do you have a favorite library that you're partial to at Square, or even your own library? Is there one that's just like your baby? Not even your baby, but just one that you really like to work on.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I definitely switch between which ones are my, you know, my baby, so to speak. I think Retrofit is probably the one that I'm most partial to, and the one that I really kind of am the, you know, person that makes decisions on.
Okay.
And I think it's the one that actually adds a ton of value as well. Not that the others don't add a ton of value. I think it's the one that adds a ton of value that can be seen most. When you add it to an app, you could really see the value that you extract from it in switching from having not used Retrofit. Of course, things are a little different now than they were, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. Retrofit's actually a 4-year-old library. But there are alternatives now, but I still think that there's just a ton of value that it provides. And I think the value proposition is so simple that people kind of immediately can see why it's useful.
Yeah, there's a huge return on investment. Like, if it's just like adding library, immediately you can sort of see that value. Makes sense.
Definitely. So is there, I don't know if this is possible or not, but maybe you can shine some light on it. Can you name any of the libraries that you guys use at Square that are not Square libraries?
Oh yeah. There's not a lot, but there's definitely a few. RxJava is obviously the biggest one. I think it pretty much finds its way into every part of the app. Google has the auto value library, which while we're not using it directly, we actually use a fork of it called auto parcel. And so people talk about parcel error, and there's another one. The way that auto parcel is different is that it's immutable. So you create an object and you can't change any of its values. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, instantly makes it thread safe, which is a big thing for us. You don't have to think about it. But the other thing that I really like about auto parcel versus something like a parceler is that the types itself are just parcelable objects. You don't have to like wrap any calls. Like when you're trying to parcel it, you don't have to wrap it in like a parceler call.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really big value add, is that you can just treat it like a parcelable object anywhere. It doesn't matter where it is. So the type itself is parcelable, and you can just hand it around, you know, hand it to a third-party library, hand it to the Android APIs just as a parcelable object. So I think the immutable nature of it and the fact that the instances are actually parcelable are the two, like, really concrete pieces of value that we extract from it.
So you guys, you have RxJava, the auto parcel. Is there any other ones that you guys use? Like maybe, I know you probably use JSON. Is there any other ones at all?
What's the other one? Protobuffers?
Protocol buffers?
So we actually have our own protocol buffer library.
That's Wire, right?
Yeah, Wire. Again, it emphasizes immutable objects, and the method count is extremely low, which is obviously important. And then another one we use is like the sticky headers libraries. So there's one for list view, there's one for recycler view. But I think we're only using the list view one right now.
Hmm.
Cool.
Quick follow-up question on that. Do you guys try to keep your method count below 65K, or do you actually embrace the multi-dex thing, or are you going to try to do like a Facebook kind of thing there?
No, so this is a... probably an unpopular opinion, but I'm actually a huge fan of the 65K method limit. I think it's very important to have constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are actual valid cases for going over 65K, I think 99%, probably even more, 99.9% of apps have no business being over that limit. So An example would be in the register, Square Register application. We actually hit the 65K method limit probably 18 months ago, a year and a half. And this is actually what spawned the Wire project, is that we saw that 35,000 methods, so over half of the methods in that 65,000 were from protocol buffers. And wow. that's just absolutely ridiculous, right? Like, this is before, you know, play services yeah. became, you know, bloated and split. And so 65,000 is just unbelievably high. And so the Wire project was started. And it, after about four weeks or so, I think we kind of got something working. And the equivalent protocol, the equivalent generated code from Wire was like 7,000 methods. So basically, yikes. You know, like one sixth wow. of the method count.
That's but wild. That's cool.
In that time, you know, in those 18 months, registrars actually hit the 65K method limit again. Except this time, it's because they've just added features.
Oh.
you know, and so they went the multi-dex route.
Gotcha.
So, you know, there, and I do think that it's a valid, like for them, yes, they want to add features, they want to move fast, and they don't want to like have to be pruning their libraries. And we don't run ProGuard, which is probably another unpopular opinion. We don't want to be like spending hours tweaking ProGuard configs. And so they just throw multi-dex.
Oh, really? Even on release builds or just on debug?
Nope, we never run ProGuard.
Wow. Yeah, that I've not heard of. Yeah.
It's, I mean, why do, it's, again, it's like an unpopular opinion. I just don't see the value in running ProGuard. Ideally, the libraries that you use are small and focused such that, you know, you don't need to strip 80% of them out. obviously, the code that's in your app should be used. I mean, if you have code that's not used, delete it.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what people are using ProGuard for, but. And then the only kind of valid case, I guess, would be the obfuscation story. And for Square, at least, all of our value proposition is on the server. It's with our integration with banks, you know, our ability to move money, all your data stored on the back end. We encrypt when you swipe your card in the reader. We actually do encryption in the reader. So there's nothing, yep. there's nothing in the app that you could, like, get access to the credit card or anything. So what's the value? Like, why would we obfuscate? There really isn't any. And so that is, I think, the only reason that one would use ProGuard. Mm-hmm. So since we don't have that, we don't use it.
Definitely. So now, is there a, you know, you're so active on open source. Is if you had to break it up, you know, given percentage of your work time, how much of your time would you say you spend on working on open source stuff versus working on feature development for the products?
It definitely varies. Right now I'm on an extremely small team and the team is actually getting smaller. We have an intern that is graduating and is going on a road trip for 2 months. thankfully he's returning after those 2 months. But so it's basically going to be myself and one other person working on the Android app.
Wow.
And I definitely will be helping in features a lot more, but this kind of goes back to how I got started in Android is that, you know, the open source stuff, while yes, I tend to work on some of it at work, I'm doing most of it because I want to, not because I have to, or not because we need it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when some people are bored, they go and they play golf or they paint mm-hmm. or they read. You know, when I'm bored, I just open up my IntelliJ and I'm working on, you know, some interesting problem. It just hasn't gotten old for me and I'm not sick of it. So I spend a lot more time programming than I think someone that's just, you know, working their, not that we do 8 to 5, but like their core of their job as programming and then doing something else constructive in their own time. For me, it just happens to be the same thing. So
cool.
I get a lot more done, I think, in that regard.
Cool. Now, is there a project that you wish that you had started, maybe like an open source project wish you'd started, but maybe don't have time or anything in that regard?
Oh, yeah, I got a good one. So Facebook recently released Stetho, which you think you guys talked about.
Yeah, a little bit.
So Square has this project called Pony Debugger. And it's a 3 or 4 year old project, which is basically the same exact thing, but for iOS.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
It's based on, you know, WebSockets, and it gives you, it's a little bit different than Stetho. It has a proxy that you connect to. So basically your app doesn't, or your phone doesn't have to be connected to your computer. As long as you're running the app, you can connect to this proxy server and get the Chrome debug tools.
Nice.
So a year ago, or a little bit more, I guess, I was like, oh, I'm going to port this to Android. And I started looking at, this is like a classic Jake Wharton problem here. You'll see where, like, I never wrote the app, but I wrote Action Bar Sherlock. The same thing's about to happen. So I looked at WebSocket libraries, and I was kind of unsatisfied with all of them. Some of them were actually probably perfectly reasonable, but we had OKHTP, and I was like, oh, I'll just, you know, whip up a WebSocket integration inside OKHTP, and then I'll write my version of the Chrome DevTools thing. Mm-hmm. And so flash forward like 8 months, and I'm still working on this WebSocket like implementation in my spare time. And one of the Facebook engineers that actually worked on Stetho, I actually know, and we had been talking about the fact that both of us were working on a Chrome DevTools thing. And this was, you know, last summer. And he's like, yeah, we're going to open source it eventually, but there's no timeline. And I was like, yeah, we'll probably open source ours eventually, but there's no timeline. So I have, you know, I have my own version of Stetho built on OKHTP's WebSockets that does similar things, and it's just not finished. And now I have no, like, now I'm not going to finish it, right? Because there's, why would I finish it? There's no reason for them to be two separate tools, which do the same exact thing. When there's not a clear like value in mine over theirs.
Exactly. So there's so many open source libraries, like just from Stetho to the one you're talking about now to the ones we've already talked about. And I know there's a new one that has come out recently that you guys released. And Kaushik, I know, wanted to bring it up. And it was SQL Bright. Did you want to talk a little bit about that, Kaushik? And
oh, yeah, sure. So, I mean, SQL Bright has been super interesting because, again, I'm sort of like, as most of us right now are, like, I'm a big fan of RxJava. So anything I think that follows the sort of like the semantics of RxJava makes sense. And obviously with data persistence, if I had something that followed that semantics, the RxJava semantics for data persistence, that would have been amazing. And SQLBrite comes out. So I've been a huge fan. But one thing that did interest me is that it's sort of extremely focused. I mean, usually most of the stuff you release is Razor focused, but SQLBrite specifically is like Razor focused on what it does. From your docs, it says like the only responsibility is to be a mechanism for coordinating and composing the notification of updates to tables, such that you can update the queries as soon as the data changes. So I basically want to touch upon some of the things with SQLBrite. To begin, what was the motivation for SQLBrite? I mean, like, why did you start SQLBrite in the first place?
So this intern that's actually leaving us has been with us for a year. And when he joined the team a year ago, I had talked to him about, you know, wanting a solution for database, because we felt that we were kind of working around having a database, because databases on Android have been traditionally not that great experience, fraught with problems, and the libraries have been questionable. And so we sat down and we evaluated, well, really he evaluated about 16 existing database libraries for Android. You know, a wide gamut, from annotation processor-based ones to plugin-based ones to reflection-based ones. And we just really found that while there were some good options, none of them came back to like the core principles that we have around libraries, which is being very focused and doing one thing and doing one thing well. So ultimately, we decided to just see what it would look like to write our own. No real initial intention of open sourcing, just getting a feel. And we knew we wanted it to be ArcJava based simply because it was very clear that that's where a lot of things were going internally, both internally and externally. And we ended up writing this extremely comprehensive solution. It was ArcJava based. It had type-safe querying. It had type-safe insertion. It had object mapping. It had an annotation processor. It had a Gradle plugin. There was talks of an IntelliJ plugin. We wrote this just like massive, massive thing. And it worked really well, and it had some bugs, but eventually we figured those would be ironed out. And we kind of sat down when we were working on this newer feature in Square Cache and wanted to use it. And in like thinking about our usage of it, we really just kind of came to the realization that it was not the right solution. It would have worked. It would have worked perfectly fine. And one of the few open source ones that already existed probably also would have worked. But we knew that the one thing we had that the open source solutions didn't have was the ArcJava notifications. We really wanted the database to be the source of truth for data, such that when you navigate to a screen and you query for anything, say, the current logged in user's name, just to put their name on the screen, if a push notification comes in that says, the user edited their profile on the web, and then we do a background sync and sync your profile and you change your name, we wanted you to just watch the app and see the app update and your name change. If anyone's ever used like Firebase for data, you see this, right? Like you do your Firebase query for a list and you put something in the list on the web or in a different app and it just gets pushed instantly. So we wanted that for local data, for the local database. So whether it was another part of the app, a background job, a push notification, anything modifying the data, and even you touching the data. So if you, check a box on an item and somewhere else on the screen, there's a count of items. We want that count to be instantly updated without you having to go and say like, oh, the data has changed, please re-query. So we knew that this was like the thing that we wanted, and everything else was kind of a nice to have. So the type safe querying, the object mapping, the annotation processor and the plugin, those were nice, but those weren't like, the thing that we really wanted. So we threw it all away. We started from scratch. I basically got on a plane from Waterloo flying back to San Francisco, and I wrote what is 80% of SQL Byte on the plane.
Nice.
And it was easy because we had done all that upfront work. We knew ArcJava. We had done, 8 months of this library development, and we knew exactly what we wanted. So it was relatively easy. And now that's not to say that eventually we won't support things like, object mapping.
The ORM aspect, yeah.
Maybe not the R, not the relational stuff. I don't think mapping relations into Java models is right. But we will do like object mapping. So if you like query a list of a table, obviously you should be able to get a list of, foo.
User.
Exactly.
User objects versus just like queries. Yeah.
And also views of that data. So if I do a join and I bring in more data, I shouldn't be forced to use a cursor. Like if I create an interface that has methods for each of the columns in that join, I should be able to just map into instances of that interface.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because I think, we think there's value in type safety and in immutability, which goes back to the other libraries that we use. And so we want to see that in SQL Byte as well.
Where do you see the future of this library going?
Yeah, I think you'll see two main things come out of it. Because I think there's two main problems. And one is in dealing with like column names. Right now we just use column names as strings and you just kind of reference those strings everywhere.
Right.
I think while that works, I think it's potentially problematic, and I would like to make that a little more safe so that if you change a column type, we kind of force you to change the types that you're using to access that column. And then the other is really in that data binding, that object mapping part. So we do this manually right now. If you look at the sample of SQL Bright, we have this pattern that we use for object mapping. We'll probably make that a little more a first party offering and allow you to like create an interface which represents the like a view of a query, or have interfaces for each table which represent the columns in the table, and allow you to create instances of that. Because again, the type safety and the immutability are the things that we want to see in the code that's interacting with the database. I really want to point out that one thing that you probably will not see is an abstraction on top of SQL, on top of SQL, the language. Because the library that I like the most for this is Juke. I don't know if you're familiar with Juke. But it basically does a ton of code generation and lets you do type safe querying. But hiding the query language basically ends up removing all of this knowledge that people have around how queries work. So instead of learning how to write queries and how to write them correctly, I learn how to write queries with this abstraction. And I learn how to trick the abstraction into making efficient queries. So you see this a lot with Hibernate. You definitely see it with the Android ORMs, and even to some degree with Juke, where you have to like learn how to make the abstraction do what you want instead of just using SQL and doing what you want.
Makes sense. One thing I also want to point out is since SQL Bright is sort of relatively new, there's huge value for people to actually go and look at the tests. Because one thing that I found is like, especially when I started off with RxJava in itself was such a steep learning curve. But being able to test RxJava efficiently is something that I had a lot of initial problems with. SQL Bright is sort of in the initial stages. So if you closely follow like the tests that's being added, it's hugely beneficial. Like it sort of gives you an idea about how to approach testing as the library evolves. So that's definitely something I would recommend listeners go and closely follow. Just watch how the tests get into the project. It'll give you a good understanding.
Yeah, it goes back to kind of what we talked about earlier, because it is an Android library, but what we really want is to be able to unit test the library. The library relies on SQLite, and it relies on Android's abstraction of SQLite, which is, you know, SQLite database and SQLite open helper. And like RoboElectric actually ships with a version of SQLite, which is very close to the one on Android, and the actual, the Android SQL wrappers. But we didn't want to do that. We didn't want to go that route because, again, we were nervous that we would end up testing the behavior of RoboElectric rather than testing the actual behavior of Android and of SQLite that runs on Android. So while we do have unit tests, those unit tests actually have to run on a device. So we use we use the new testing frameworks and.
Right.
We run them on actual devices rather than on the JVM.
Makes sense. Oh, so one quick last sort of thing related to this is one, I've always wanted sort of like this view binding sort of thing that works with RxJava. Now, Rx Android sort of has this in some places with like the widget observable that's come in. What are your thoughts on that? Do you at some point see like a way where SQL Bright would sort of interface? Because one very sort of common requirement is with cursor loaders, right? Like everyone hates loaders, and I think that's like a universal sort of feeling towards loaders. Nobody likes the API,
yes.
But they do solve a very useful problem, right? I mean, like one that was like my initial sort of like pull towards SQL Bright, because I guess like loaders help with sort of like keeping your list view sort of updated with like data, like from a huge data set. And like as you scroll, it sort of pulls the data, and like cursor loaders help with sort of huge swaths of data. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see SQL Bright or possibly like maybe even RX Android or like something else, or like a sort of interface between the two where we sort of get that functionality? I want to get rid of loaders. What should I be doing? Is my question. Yeah.
It's definitely a very appealing like ideal because this is also where we really want to be. As I mentioned, we really want SQLite pushing data into the UI and having that update automatically. And so, yeah, right now it's a bit unfortunate because you kind of have to do that the last mile yourself. You get the data pushed into your callback, and maybe you're already getting object representations of that data, so the list of user, as you said. But yeah, it's still your responsibility to put that in an adapter and hook that adapter up to a list view. And we actually have no story around pagination.
Yeah, yeah.
There is an issue on SQLite that is kind of just a placeholder and talks about pagination, because we definitely are thinking about it. But yeah, so the widget observable in RX Android. So I peeked ahead a bit, and I see where the show notes are going. So this will actually be a great transition.
Yeah.
The widget observable in RX Android, and this is kind of a pathological problem with all of RX Android, is that it's really not that great for a proper view binding, like a comprehensive view binding solution. Yes, it has some things you can put, like you can bind an observable of string into a text view, and then you no longer have to bind that text directly into a text view. And so this is like aiming to solve that last mile from your observable data into your actual UI. But yeah, it's like it has some methods for common things like observing clicks and putting data into a text view and changing like the enabledness of a view and visibility, things like that. But it's really not comprehensive. And this is something we aspire to. So recently we've undertaken work of basically just replacing RX Android, throwing it all away and starting from scratch and really going after something that's much more comprehensive and is has a very strong opinion on what it's aiming to do. You see a lot of things in RX Android that you say, oh, that's interesting. Maybe someday I'll get to use this, or maybe someday I'll have the use case where this will matter. And then I think one of the reasons, and that's kind of a fundamental problem, because then someone writes, you as a user of RX Android, you write something and you say, wow, like this should really be in RX Android. And it goes back to what I talked about earlier and what we talked about in the Montreal keynote, which is if I'm writing this, then, everyone must have this problem and I need to contribute this back to the library. And because RX Android has never really had a strong opinion or a strong direction on what it was trying to be and where it was trying to go, you kind of have this like hodgepodge of features and functionality. So anyway, basically getting to what I think you were going to next is we have this solution where we're focusing on binding to the UI as the first step. And so this is both in observing changes in the UI, whether it's from clicks or checking a checkbox or changing a seek bar progress value or any interaction with the UI that ultimately triggers a listener, of turning those into observables so you can simply observe them in your RX Java streams. And then on the other side, taking data from observables and getting them into the UI. And so yes, we have the text, taking a string or a character sequence and binding it to the text of a text view. But we also want to look at the additional properties of a view. So maybe you're animating and you're spitting out, values of animation. Or maybe again, back to the seek bar or the checkbox, maybe you're emitting whether those should be checked or the progress of a seek bar or the enabledness of a button or a form. So Dan, I believe, on the Rx Java episode alluded to like disabling a form when a button is clicked not disabling, but showing like an error state.
Yeah,
exactly. So we want to kind of take that even further where not only are you like validating the data in the form, but you're extracting data from that form with RxJava and potentially putting data into the form with RxJava to kind of, again, do that like last mile of data binding to the UI. And this is actually where the CycleJS, the stuff I talked about earlier, the JavaScript library, I've been pulling a lot of just patterns and ideas from this JavaScript library. And it's the most simple library. I think it touts like a 600 line file and that's all it is.
Wow.
But like the pattern of the code that you end up writing with it is really interesting. And so that's what we're trying, you know, we're never going to get to where it is just because of the limitations of Java. And we obviously can't create objects and throw them away rapidly because of garbage collection issues. But we want to get to this point where there's no code sitting in your view or your presenter or your fragment or your activity. There's no code that is like imperative binding to the UI code. So you make your query with SQLBrite or wherever your data is coming from. It's coming in as an RxJava observable. And rather than subscribing to it and then explicitly calling, textview.setText, you are subscribing your UI to it. So you're saying, with this observable, subscribe this text view's text property directly to it. So we've done this basically for a lot of things. The Square Cash app is not using Rx Android anymore. It's using our version of it.
Okay.
I would really love, so it's also open source. It's not a library that is a library in any sense of the word. I really just threw it over the wall because I want other people to look at it and to see what's going on inside of it. Mostly so I could, get advice, and make sure it's doing the right things and, potentially would be solving their problems. And I have a long-term hope of eliminating it and switching the actual Rx Android over to, if not all of it, at least part of it to this version. Mm-hmm. Because I think it has what Rx Android lacks, which is a very, very strong, opinion. It has a very, real goal. And I think it can kind of elevate at least the view binding part of Rx Android to where it may not cover all your use cases, but it's not kind of this hodgepodge of a few binding methods that have varying behaviors, such as that you have now with Rx Android.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, basically the glue between your observables and the your Android views is both, it's such an easy sell, right? I mean, if I could just, like, if I had like a list view and an adapter and I just have this observable and I tell the adapter, hey, here's the observable and now do what you need to be doing. Because it's like a very sort of standard ask. I mean, that in any application, that is this general ask. Like, you have data and you bind it to a view and you don't want to be dealing with it ever again. You want it to just be taken care of. And you have to keep writing the same code all over again and again in different places. So, yeah. So this weekend, Jake, you think you can pull it off this weekend? Because I have a project that I need to get done by next week. So,
I see you actually mentioned this, but one of the things that we put, that I put very explicitly up front, is that this is like it's not a library to be a library, at least not yet. So there's not going to be releases, you're not going to just pull it from Maven Central. There's no stability guarantees, no API guarantees. Right. Basically, anything could come and go and disappear at any time without warning.
I was hoping I could just like gloss over that part and like, you know, I could sort of like indirectly convince you to not think of it like that. But
I mean,
it seems like you have your thoughts set on it.
Yeah. Like I said, though, this is driving our app, right? Like we are using this in our app and it is 100% production ready code. Right. It's just, once you get into making releases and releases imply, you know, API stability and backwards compatibility. And I also don't want to fork the Rx Android community. Mm-hmm. Rx Android should be the source of truth for Rx Java on Android. It's not required, right? Like you don't have to use Rx Android, but I would really like if everyone would and everyone wanted to. And I think the project has, like I said, really lacked a strong focus. And hopefully over time we can take this viewbinding piece and put it in Rx Android and start to really create value proposition in that library, because that's where it should be and that's where it should live. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the big reasons is I really don't want to create, I don't want to make Rx Android obsolete, and I don't want to fork. Even worse would be like, you know, forking the community between two libraries, because then you have interop problems. Mm-hmm. With Rx Android, we have the potential of allowing you to write libraries which depend on Rx Android, and then when someone pulls them in, you know, they're like, oh, you know, yes, it depends on Rx Java, but oh, it depends on Rx Android. That makes total sense because it's an Android library. Whereas if we end up forking the community through, you know, making this a Square library or even my own library that has releases, what happens when someone depends on something in Rx Android, and what happens when someone depends on this different version of it? That's, you know, that's the worst possible situation.
It would actually be nice if like sort of the view binding piece functioned independently though. Like if, I mean, I'm not saying necessarily that it has to be forked away from Rx Android, but the thing is Rx, it goes back to like the Play Services thing, right? Like eventually Rx Android might turn out to be like this Goliath service. Like you have like a bunch of things. It would be nice to sort of like have sort of like razor focused sort of abilities within like Rx Android. So if I wanted just like the scheduler sort of like components of Rx Android, then that would be nice to like sort of pull out independently. If I wanted the view binding aspect, that would be nice to sort of like pull out independently, because I mean, like you said, sometimes it's not necessarily that we want all of the features, but it would be nice to have like that going. Just a thought.
I think you'll see that because I totally agree with you. I think there should be a very lean core which has like the scheduler and not much else. I mean, there's a few things that are kind of fundamental to adapting to Android, the scheduler being one. But then, yeah, like having these like a la carte libraries that you can pull in. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want viewbinding. Another one that Dan talked about was like this lifecycle observable that ties into the Android lifecycle. That is an extremely useful observable if you're using fragments and activities a bunch. So like we don't use that because our application is one activity, no fragments. So our lifecycle is, you know, we don't have a lifecycle basically. We decouple, our lifecycle is either the view is on screen and the view is off screen, or it's completely decoupled from the UI lifecycle and it's just the lifetime of the process. So now with Rx Android, I pay the cost of, you know, having those in the core, having those in the library. And so should they be there? Because I think there's a lot of room to expand the lifecycle observable into having like a base activity or a base fragment that you could extend from, which gives you that stuff that ties into the lifecycle automatically. Mm. There's actually a pull request right now that ties into the application activity lifecycle callbacks to give it to you automatically. Mm-hmm. And that's like a great component that could just be a focus piece that you pull in.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, there's huge potential for that being used.
Cool. Well, I think Rx Android and all the supporting libraries are things we should definitely take a look at and keep an eye on. I know that I'm using them, Kaushik's using them, you guys are doing some great stuff with them. It's something that's going to evolve over time, and I've seen a lot of work from Dan and you and a lot of conversations happen in that area. So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out. We have literally so many more things on our list of things to cover here that we want to talk about, and we're already probably into our second episode at this point in time. So we're going to have to cut this one short. Jake, we're going to have to get you back on for another show here in the near future. So that's going to kind of wrap it up for us. But before we get going, let's go ahead and hop into a couple of the awesome picks for the week. And for any of the new listeners that we have, each episode we share some of the cool links that we found throughout the web and that are related to Android development in one way or another. And so I have a few, Kaushik has some, and then we usually ask our guests to share a couple if they have any. I'll hop right into it. This week I only have two links. One is a link from a website called Philosophical Hacker. I'm messing it up right now. I can't speak straight. And it's about Android testing. And he says the topic is, why is Android unit testing so hard? Part one. And it's a multi-part post. And I kind of am posting this here because the topics he brings up are arrange, act, assert, how to organize a unit test. Here's how you're going to, you should set up unit testing inside of Android. And this is a lot of stuff we already talked about. But what I noticed is when I read this, I felt like I was taking a step 10 years back. A lot of these discussions are a lot of the discussions that other languages had 10 years ago. So it's interesting to me to see how Android is finally now catching up, even though Android is, I think it's 8 years old to the public in that regard. The second link that I have is, I just found yesterday, it's, I don't know how the right way to say this, so if you guys know, let me know. I think it's SquidDB or SqueeDB. It's Yahoo's new SQLite layer for Android, and they're kind of operating on like this ORM level and a SQLite abstraction. I haven't used it. I just thought that it was interesting, and if anyone is interested to take a look, just check the show notes for the links.
Right. Jake, how about you go next?
Yeah, so mine, actually, none of them relate to Android directly. I'm going to go back to what I said about kind of diversifying your exposure to languages and other ways of doing things. And something I said at a talk I gave at DroidCon recently was that we as engineers somewhere have a level where everything beneath that is a black box. And so the example I gave was like an HTTP client. A lot of people know how HTTP works, but they don't really know how an HTTP client actually parses HTTP and, you know, coordinates all the things that are required. And so that's a black box to them. And that's fine, right? Like, we all have black boxes somewhere. Maybe you understand how HTTP client works, but you don't understand how, when you write bytes to a socket, how those actually get, you know, sent across, you know, through your network card. And, you know, that's like where my black box is. So I have four links. And all of them are with the intention of pushing down your black box. So exposing you to things that you might not understand how they work, but and you might not understand everything in these four articles, because I know I certainly did, and I've, you know, read a couple of them a few times. But so there's four. There's one which is about on Rust, which is a new language that I talked about, and it has this very interesting concept of ownership of objects. And so you have to like borrow objects in order to access them. Mm-hmm. And the compiler actually enforces those lifetimes and those borrowings. So errors that otherwise would be runtime errors are now caught by the compiler. Mm-hmm. I have one on how Git works, the actual internals of Git, mm-hmm. How it creates things, how, you know, the tree works, how references work. The third one is about gzip. I think a lot of people know what gzip is, but might not actually understand how gzip works. Mm-hmm. And so this talks about the encoding that gzip uses. It's really fascinating. It uses a poem and talks about how the Raven poem would be encoded with gzip. and then my last one is actually about Java 10. So I guess it's Java related. Which kind of can be thought of Android. And it just talks about how this feature that's coming in Java 10, which is value objects, about all the problems and all the considerations that have to be taken into account in order to add this to the language. And so for those that don't know, a value object basically means, instead of creating an object and having that put on the heap, which is where objects are stored, It's basically kept on the stack, which is the kind of can be thought about the same as like a local variable. So you, even though you have a complex object like a point, which has, you know, an X and Y coordinate, instead of an object on the heap, this becomes an object that behaves and has the performance of a local object. And so four links, none of them directly related, you know, to your day-to-day Android, but just trying to get you exposed to a bunch of new things that might end up coming back and, you know, contributing to your knowledge of how you build Android apps.
Love it. Excellent. So the reason I asked both of you guys to go first is because my recommendations are not even related to development this week. So sometime back, I basically got this huge monitor, like I talked about. It's a 27-inch IPS monitor, and there's this link. I'll add a link to the show notes. So Jeff Atwood from the Coding Horror blog talked about this some time back, and essentially what people are doing now is like ordering huge these high-res monitors from Korean eBay vendors. So I actually did that. I bit the bullet because it's actually considerably cheaper. Like if you had to get like the equivalent sort of monitor here, it would be like $700 a pop or something. Oh. So, but this landed up being like $280 or $300. So I bit the bullet and I ordered one, and it came, and I'm loving it. I'm actually a crazy, like, I have this crazy setup usually both at my office and like at home. I have like two monitors on the side, one on the other, like one vertical monitor on the side on my right. I go crazy with my monitors. But this one is super huge. It's like 27 inch, and I've been trying to sort of like focus in on just having a single monitor, but a really huge monitor, so I don't feel like I'm running out of space. So I'll add a link to the actual vendor that I used and also to the Coding Horror blog link. That's my first. The second is for people who know me, I'm a crazy, I watch like a bunch of TV shows. There's the new Daredevil show on Netflix, and I think it's pretty good. So if you're interested in the Marvel Universe, the Daredevil show is done really well. I think it's really good. I haven't gone through the whole thing yet. I'm, I think, 3 or 4 episodes down. But yeah, I think people would enjoy that. All right, so those are that's it for this show. It's time to wrap it up. You can find the show notes for this episode at fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/6. If you have feedback or suggestions for us, as always, please send in your comments. You can basically add your comments directly at the show notes at the link I just mentioned, or you can send a tweet directly to us. You can send it to either Don or me. We have this Twitter account that we've started. We don't know where we're going with it, but I think that would be a nice place to sort of like send feedback or comments, or if you want to like get in touch with us. The Twitter handle is fragmentedcast. So that's fragmented and CAST at the end. Okay, so if people wanted to get hold of you, Jake, what's the best way?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at just Jake Wharton, at Jake Wharton. I also have a blog, which is woefully sparse in postings, which is just jakewharton.com. But I'm most frequently seen, I guess, frolicking around GitHub, and I'm Jake Wharton there as well.
Perfect. Don, what about you?
If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can reach me on Twitter at Don Felker, DonFelker. That's going to be the easiest way, and I'll probably get back to you very quickly. If you need a longer form response, you can contact me via my blog or website. It's DonFelker.com. Again, that's two N's and Don.
Perfect. And if people want to get hold of me, I'm Kaushik Gopal. That's KaushikGopal on Twitter. And my website is kaush.co. That's KaushH.co. Thank you all for listening. And we want to thank Jake, especially for coming on this these two shows. I imagine this is going to be two shows. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. I had a blast, and I'm sure Don did as well, chatting with you, and we hope you do come on to the show again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'd love to come back.
Thanks, awesome. Jake.